Hi, welcome back to Story Hodge. This is Jennifer Robinson, and today I'm with my friend Jen.
Hi, Jen.
Hi, Jen. So we're in Kansas City, Missouri.
Not quite. We're technically in Kansas, but we can look at Kansas City, Missouri out the window.
We're on the line.
We're on the state line.
Okay. So I just drove up today to see you. Just for tonight. Actually, we went to a Paul Simon concert.
It was pretty awesome.
Yes, it was amazing. And we'll talk about that in a minute. But we first met, I think, in 2011.
Okay.
In California.
I remember.
And that was through our mutual friend that I went to university with. My friend is Sarah. And you were the roommate of her fiancé at the time.
I was, yes.
And Sarah, so I had just, we both, Sarah and I had been in international studies and we were graduating and I was going to be looking for work, I think, overseas. And so she was like, my fiance's roommate does this and you need to talk with her. And so you were so nice to, like, I remember we had like a meeting.
Yeah, I remember it being at the house.
Yeah, it was like the you know, because I think I had interned in D.C. Well, not I think I interned. I did intern in D.C., and that's where they start teaching you about, like, you have to have all these meetings with people and sort of network and stuff like that. But I wasn't very, like, great at that. Nobody really likes that when you're first starting out. But I feel like that's kind of, like, what that was.
Yeah, I think it was a chance to talk about my experiences overseas and try to give you some ideas of places you could try to find work when you graduated.
And I think it's really unique because you worked in two places where at the time I never wanted to go, really. You worked in Afghanistan and in Iraq.
Yep.
And so those places weren't really on my radar at all.
Because you had spent some time in Africa before then, right?
Yes, I had done some like volunteering before university, and that's what made me go back to school and think like, oh, I should actually get some training, some education, so I can do this a lot better. And so that was a great conversation. And then we just became social media friends. And then I end up in Iraq, and it's great. It's been like great to have you on the other end because I feel like you're a total support because you know what's going on. And as well, you're a bit of a writer, which like I love all of your writing. So I'm always waiting for whatever you're posting. And, like, I'm just, like, anytime something new, I have to gobble it up because it's really good.
Well, and it's interesting because I like following you on social media because I've been home now for a few years. And it's neat to see people who are still involved in the issues and the people and the countries that I have a connection to because of the time I've spent there.
Yeah. Yeah. There is some sort of bond, I think.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So you can get together, I think, with anyone, like, who's had a similar experience and be able to talk forever.
Yeah. And I think, too, when you come back from having an expat life and you're in the U.S. and you're reconnecting with all your old friends who don't necessarily understand that experience, it's nice to be able to spend time with people, whether they're close friends or not, or maybe the lion's share of your friendship's been over social media, but you know what they've been through and they know what you've been through, and it brings you together in a way that you don't have that common experience with most of the people in your life.
It's funny because I think it can even be hard to talk about it with your family because they don't even know what to ask. And so I was just with my mom and brother for about 3 weeks and we didn't really talk about anything about what I've been doing. So I thought I will do a PowerPoint presentation for them because that's what I know how to do. Like I know how to do PowerPoint presentations. So I'm currently working on putting together like my slides.
I have an old PowerPoint presentation I used when I got back from Afghanistan.
Oh, that's awesome.
I'll share a few of those slides with you. It might help.
Oh, that's so funny. So at least it's not cheesy because I was like, it's a little cheesy, but
I guess. No, I did the same thing.
People don't have photo albums anymore. So it's not like you're going to flip through.
They don't. And I think the other problem we have is people see what you chose to share on Facebook with the world, which is such a small slice of what you experienced. And was only the positive stuff you experienced because you didn't want people to worry about you. And I think people think they have the whole story because they absorbed what you chose to share on social media. And that isn't reflective of the whole experience you had.
Yeah, that's a great point. But I don't want to think about that because I don't want my mom to be like, oh, no, she's only showing me the good side. So just
sorry, Mom, but we're only showing you the good side.
Okay, Jen, can you say a little bit about what you do now?
Yeah, I work with the Army, and we train command staffs on how to work with foreign governments, how to work with civilian agencies in dealing with a lot of the different issues that they have to take on in this new environment. We do everything from, we trained the 101st Airborne Division that went over to Liberia for the Ebola mission. We help people deploy before they go to Iraq and Afghanistan, work with U.S. forces in Korea. Basically, all around the world where U.S. forces and their allies have to work to coordinate their activities with foreign governments and civilian agencies, we help them understand what their responsibilities are.
And that includes something like classroom training as well as actual simulations.
We do war simulation, classroom training. I write papers. We role play. And we even develop mini exercises that are based specifically on interagency challenges.
Mm. Well, I really appreciate that because I feel like I'm the beneficiary in some way as I like am I'm working in Iraq and I know that those guys are there sort of doing their job and trying like keeping us all safe and
if
the
they
country.
Paid attention in my class.
Let's hope so. Let's cross our fingers. Okay, so Jen, you have a story about the reason why we went to the Paul Simon concert tonight. He has a song that's really meaningful to you, and you were so excited to go. So maybe you could share a little bit about your story.
I was, and I was so excited that you could come up today and be a part of that with Ambassador Jackson and me. And it was so neat to be there for his music with all of his African undertones. With
yes.
Two women who've spent, you know, significant time
yes.
and had amazing experiences in Africa. So, I was so excited when I saw that Paul Simon was going to be at Starlight. And I put it on my calendar months ago. And the reason is, when I was in law school, I was in a long-term relationship that wasn't a good relationship at all. And I had some concerns and was thinking about getting out of the relationship. And one day, on the way to school, my fiancé at the time had told me a story about he had all this extra time on his hands. And
why did he have the extra time?
Well, I was trying to pull away and, you know, making other plans and trying to create some space to figure out what I wanted. And he had all this extra time and how he was spending it. And I asked him how. And I had hoped he was going to tell me he was volunteering or picking up a hobby. And he told me he was spending his spare time watching Jerry Springer.
And that he was happy about that.
He was so happy. He was getting so much entertainment out of this. And in that moment, you know, I'd had my reservations before this. But in that moment, I knew this was not the person I wanted to spend my life with or have a family with. And I thought about it all day in class. And on our way home from law school that day, I told him in the car, which I learned, don't break up with somebody when he's driving. But I told him in the car, I said, you know, I just can't do this anymore. And he said, carpool? You can't, if you don't want to ride together on Wednesdays, that's fine. You can drive yourself. And I said, no, I can't do this anymore. And he knew I wasn't that excited about law school. And he said, oh, just stick with it. It's your first year. You know, once you finish first year, things will get better. And I said, no, I can't do this anymore. Making clear that I was talking about the relationship. And it took him for a surprise, and he was really upset, and he drove me home, dropped me off at my apartment. And I went into my apartment, and I sat on my couch, and I thought, okay, I just ended a 4-year relationship. I just called off an engagement.
Out of the blue.
Well,
for him, at least.
For him, out of the blue.
Yeah.
And it kind of been coming for me, but
all because of Jerry Springer.
I just had that moment where I said, this isn't the person for me. And I sat there, and there were a lot of other reasons, too, we don't need to go into. But I sat on the couch, and I told myself, you know, Jen, you can cry. It's time to process these emotions, figure out how you feel about this, cry your tears. And I sat there for a couple minutes, and I realized I didn't have any more tears to cry. I shed plenty in the 4 years we were together, and I was just done. And I got up, and I walked over to my little stereo, and Paul Simon's Negotiations and Love Song CD was there, and I turned it on. And I played it, and I started dancing. And I was so happy, and I was celebrating. And each song, I turned it up a little bit more. A couple songs in, Me and Julio Down by the Schoolyard comes on. And that is just the happiest song.
Yeah.
And I just started dancing and bouncing around the apartment.
Like, you're celebrating.
I had a 220-pound anvil lifted off of my chest. And it's something...
You've broken off an engagement.
I did, but... I had absolute clarity. It was the right thing to do.
I
mean,
I think that's amazing because that's something that I think we as women in particular, we have so much anxiety about something like that. And yeah. You made the decision over the course of a law school class, like one day, just a couple hours, space of time, and had the clarity. And then now you're dancing.
Now I'm dancing.
You're like celebrating. So there's no anxiety.
No, I'm turning up the music because I knew. I knew it was the right thing. I knew he wasn't the right person for me. And I wanted peace. And I didn't have peace in my life with him in my life. And there was a knock on the door, and I was convinced it was a neighbor calling about, or stopping by to complain about the noise. And I was dancing and happy, and I flowed threw the door open. And there he was standing there holding a box of my stuff.
Your ex.
My ex. He rushed home, found everything he could in his house that was mine, threw it in a box, and brought it right to my apartment. And the look on his face at the time, he was so angry. And just rage was coming out of his face. And I grabbed my box, and I closed the door, and I went back to dancing.
And basically, he had caught you mid-dance, right? Mid-dance. Like he could tell you were
me
happy.
And Julio down by the schoolyard, and all those rhythmic sounds and that African backbeat, and just
oh my god,
all the fun that is that song. And I was so happy, and I was joyful. I was really joyful for the first time in a long time in that moment. And he saw it, and he saw me celebrating, ending our engagement. And that song to me, that means freedom. That's what I hear when I hear that song.
I think just even that short story in itself is like so great for young women to hear because we really don't know how to break off engagements in particular when we know they're bad. We do them anyway and we get divorced 10 years later.
My advice is don't do it while they're driving.
Yeah. Okay. Noted. I don't know if I'll ever get the opportunity again, but noted. Okay. So Jed, you have... like another interesting story about heartbreak.
I do. And it's hard because I have a lot of good stories and hopefully not all my best ones involve my heart getting broken. But I did fall in love once. I definitely a different type of relationship than the one I had with the me and Julio down by the schoolyard guy. And it didn't work out for a lot of good reasons, but he's somebody who I still hold dear to my heart. And the relationship didn't work, and we broke up, and I really struggled after that breakup, and I got in a rut, and I just couldn't get past the heartbreak. I couldn't get past the sadness and the struggle, and there were some other things in my life that weren't going great, but I knew I needed to do something to get myself out of that rut, to shake things up, and to create some space to recover and to move on. And that's when I agreed to move to Iraq.
So, I mean, that's a crazy story.
I was probably a little crazy then.
What were you doing before that?
I was working with the California State Legislature. I was district director for an assemblyman who went on to become the Republican leader in the state Senate. A great guy, great job. But I didn't really see any promotion potential. I didn't see myself moving up. I was renting a basement from my friend who ended up marrying your friend. And I just wasn't getting ahead. And I actually was suffering through grief from having lost a very good friend a few years prior. And I just looked at my life and thought, I don't know when I'm ever going to be able to pay off my student loans. I don't know when I'm ever going to get where I'm going. And I looked at myself in the mirror one day and said, this just isn't the life that I thought I'd be living when I was young and growing up and had dreams. And I was 32 years old at the time, and I wasn't happy with the choices I had made and where it had gotten me. And a big part, the driving force of all this was the heartbreak that I was having a difficult time recovering from. So it was a big change when I agreed to move to a Marine base in Ramadi, Iraq, and work with the local government there to try to help them through their elections and the transition into the new government.
And then, so tell me about your first day there.
Oh, my first day. My first day in Ramadi. Well, let's start with leaving Jordan.
Okay.
Because we fly from Jordan into Baghdad, actually. And it was such an interesting day. We'd shown up to the airport, and the Army has that hurry up and wait mentality. Hurry up, get there by a certain time, just so you can stand around for a few hours. So we got there, and there was a lot of us, and we knew not everybody was going to get on the plane. And everybody was trying to angle to make sure they were one of the, there was way more people than space on the C5 that we were coming in on. And everybody's dressed the same. Everybody has their khaki pants and their hiking boots and their polo shirts. And it was, 95% men. And it was a mix of contractors and diplomats and various people. And I remember looking around this room and somebody pointing out somebody who was also going to be working in Ramadi. And I went over and introduced myself to him, and he didn't want to talk. So I felt awkward, and I didn't know anyone, and it was a crowd of people, and it was really hot. It was probably about 120 degrees that day in Jordan, in Amman. And
it was only going to get hotter in Baghdad.
It was only going to get hotter. And we get on the plane, and as we're taxiing down the runway, I had that feeling like you have on a roller coaster when it's going up slowly, and it's too late to turn around. Like, no matter what you do, you are not getting off this ride. And that's the way I felt on the C5, taxiing down the runway. I thought, I had that feeling in the pit of my stomach, no matter what, I can't turn around. this plane is going to take off, and it's going to land in Baghdad. And my new life is starting. And it's about an hour and a half flight. It's really hot on the C5. Most people end up sleeping a lot of the trip, but I couldn't sleep. And when we landed, the back of the C5 opens up, and you're in Baghdad. And it was about 135 degree heat index on the runway that day.
Oh my gosh!
It was like walking into an
135.
Oven. I discovered that day that my knees could sweat.
Oh, I've known that for a while, but that is a sad discovery.
That first day you discover your knees are capable of sweating. And I remember walking off that C5. I still have a picture, because it was one of the last people off, of all of us walking in formation off this plane. And with the first thing that happens is they throw your PPE at you, personal protective equipment. So your body armor and your helmet, they literally throw it at you because you have to put it on immediately when you land. So first off, heat like you've never imagined.
Yeah.
And next thing you know, you got to put on 45 pounds of body armor and a helmet that's trapping the heat in your body. And now your knees are sweating. So bad. And that day security was bad. So the convoy between the airport and the embassy wasn't going. So everybody had to go on the helicopters. And there was only a couple helicopters, and you could only fit a few people on each helicopter. And there's over 100 people on the C5. So some of the people ended up waiting for hours to get on the helicopter. I got on the first helicopter. And I think it's because they looked at me and just felt sorry. I was so out of my element. I had my suitcase with me. And I remember with my body armor on and my helmet, 130 plus degrees, walking into the wind created by the propeller of the helicopter. And I'd never done it before. The wind actually pushed me back a few steps. And one of the things they teach you is you have to carry everything you pack, right?
Yeah.
Nobody else can carry it. You don't want to be that person who needs help. And I remember one of the security guys in the helicopter actually hopping off the helicopter to grab my luggage, I think because he felt so bad for me.
Did you bring more than one bag?
That day, that's hard to remember. They got a backpack and a rolling suitcase.
Yeah, I don't pack light. I take everything.
Oh, I do now.
I have the whole time. And oh, wow. It's just like I show up with two giant, like, they're from REI, but they're the kind of just canvas bag that has no pockets. It's like a body bag. Mm-hmm. I take two. And because I just want all my stuff.
Oh, no, I didn't have that much. I just had a rolling bag and a backpack.
And you were going for a year that time, right?
Well, I'd shipped things ahead of time.
Oh, that's smart. Okay, so you're
good. We had APO, thankfully. Okay. So, but I remember
what a welcome.
Walking into this wind and it pushing me back a few steps and being that person on the runway that, you know, naive.
Yeah, and you have like a red face.
I was a tomato. They called me a tomato.
I turn into a tomato too.
No, I got on the helicopter. Helicopter drops us off, you know, outside the embassy, but I had no idea where I was going.
Yeah.
I remember I had probably 80 pounds of stuff on top of the 45 pounds of body armor in the 130 plus degree weather, and not knowing what I'd signed up for. And I remember walking into the embassy, and thankfully a couple of guys from class saw me, and they were like, I think that tomato looks like Jen Vitella. And I, by this point, I was so burdened by the weight of everything. I was at a 90-degree angle with the floor, with the backpack on my back and the body armor. And the minute I heard my name, I just dropped it all on the marble floors of the embassy, because that was back when the embassy was Saddam's old palace.
Yes.
Dropped it on the floor of the palace and just collapsed. But I was there. Now, the best story from my first night, we're not even there yet. But so we get in, and that night the movie was showing in the basement. So I'm sitting there. I don't even remember which movie it was. But how surreal to have started my day in Amman, Jordan, which my trip to Amman was my first time in the Middle East.
Okay.
And I'm
wow.
Yes. And I'm ending my day watching a movie in Saddam's palace basement.
Yes.
Which, eating popcorn.
Yeah.
And then it was time to go back to my little transient trailer until it was time to go to Ramadi. And the sirens went off, the duck and cover sirens, and I didn't know what to do, and I didn't know where to go. Well, they weren't really good with orientation back then. And I remember putting my body armor on inside my trailer, not because I didn't know.
I don't know either. Was that the right thing or the wrong thing?
No, I should have probably gone to a duck and cover shelter. But to put my body armor on in my trailer, it probably wouldn't have helped me much.
I think I would just like lay down and put it on top of me.
Well, I mean, it's 45 pounds, so it's kind of heavy. But what happened next is I heard some noise on my roof, and I didn't know what it was. So I ended up going to sleep with my body armor on and my helmet on my bed.
On your first night.
On my first night, because I was so scared. I didn't know what to do. And I woke up the next morning, and when I went outside my trailer, I realized that it was summertime, and it was date season.
Yes.
And my trailer had been under a date palm. And what had been hitting my roof at night were the dates falling from the palm tree. And at the time, I thought maybe it was indirect fire. So I had slept in my PPE all because of the dates that were hitting my roof.
That's a funny story.
Yeah,
that's a great story for the grandkids. Or for the opening of your book. I don't know. Is that the story you're going to open your book with?
Oh, I haven't decided yet. I'm not sure. Possibly. I think maybe that feeling I had going off the runway in Amman.
Would be the opening scene.
I'll never forget that. Yeah. Yeah, that roller coaster feeling.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I'm not sure. But anyway, it's a crazy night. And that's when I knew I was completely out of my element.
So, I mean, you went there to get over the heartbreak. And did it work?
It did. It took some time. I remember being about 3 months into my deployment, having a particularly difficult day, and there was a sandstorm I got caught in. And when I went back to my trailer to take a shower, to wash the sand off, I got just enough water to turn it into mud before the electricity went out.
Oh no.
And back then you didn't have water running if you didn't have electricity. So I was standing in the dark, in the heat, caked in mud. And in that moment, and crying, I started crying because my spirit was broke.
Mm.
And in that moment, thinking, I'm never going to get my heart broken so much that I end up in this situation. So I think, you know, over time I did. It wasn't right away. I was thinking the other day, though, about the irony that I have a completely different life now.
Mm.
And it's a life that I love. Mm. 10 million times more than the life I used to have.
Wow.
And I have the life I love because somebody didn't love me back.
Hmm. Wow. That's profound.
It makes me appreciative of everything I have. And I've even told him, you know, we're friends now, and I still care about him. And I think about the fact that I look at him and think, oh, had it worked out, nothing in his life would be any different. Mm. He'd probably still have the job he has and live where he lives, and I would be living his life with him.
Yeah.
And instead, I left.
Yeah.
And I went and found a whole new life that is a better fit for me.
Yeah. I think that's that part gives me chills a little bit. It's a better fit for you. And I think, like, the same thing for myself. Like, the life I have is a great fit for me. You know, I don't know why, but it just is. And
but it's an unconventional life.
Yeah.
And it takes courage to live that life.
Yeah.
And you keep pursuing it, which is why I think our connection over social media, in spite of not being traditional friends, it is so important to both of us.
Yeah.
Because I admire all the choices you've made.
Thanks.
And continue to make. And it's been interesting to watch those. You know, we met after I'd finished my three tours in Iraq and Afghanistan. But since I've been home, I've been able to watch you grow through your time overseas. And it's neat for me.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it is so amazing. I don't know, the journey. Because I was gone for 4 years. 2 years in South Sudan and then the 2 years in Iraq. And the first 2 years for me were so hard because I didn't know what I was doing either. And I was just Googling stuff, you know. And when you start out, you're like, I started in an internship, mm-hmm. but there was nobody teaching me what to do. It was sort of the first 3 months you were supposed to sort of watch and just learn about the organization and what they do, and not, they don't give you very much responsibility. And then the second half of that first internship, you were supposed to pick your focus. And so I had kind of requested, I want to be a part of this one child protection program in Yida, which is this refugee camp, which at the time was one of the most difficult to access refugee camps in the world, which of course I didn't really think about all of that. I have no context. And the girl who was leading the project ended up getting married and also getting sick the week I arrived, and so handed me the grant the day it was signed and said, here, implement this. I'm leaving. I'm never coming back. And so that was it. Like, I had no, you know, I just had to learn really quick. I had never seen a grant before or a proposal or knew anything. And then so it was a steep, like, learning curve really quickly.
But it didn't break you.
That first year almost did. But I love it. And the second year was so much better. And I started to, you know, you start to feel more comfortable and know what to do. Yeah. And you start making decisions that, you know, you understand the context and, you know, things like the pieces just start to fit and make sense. Right. And it all just, you know, and I'm very relational. So I love the aspect of what I do, like in camp management and community services, is connecting a lot with people. And now, like in Iraq, you know, we work a lot with our national staff who speak English and have very high competency in everything. So they do everything and we just manage. And so then it's, you pour so much of yourself into your staff.
Right.
And you see them learn about the humanitarian context for the first time. And they're all learning and they're loving it and they catch it and they're on fire, you know, to support their own community. So it's amazing. And I'm really happy with that. Like, this is what I get to do mm-hmm. by chance that I fell into this.
Well, I mean, you sort of fell into it, but you also paved your path.
A little bit.
You did. You went and studied, you knew what you wanted to do, and you've built on your experiences. I am, my first year in Ramadi, there were a lot of failures. There were, I often joke that I had 50 cows stolen from me twice.
What?
Yes, that's a whole other story.
But I feel like we need that story. What is that? What?
So we had this great idea that was presented to us, and these Iraqi widows, they wanted 50 cows to develop a dairy co-op. And Land O'Lakes offered to come out and help. And we went out and we bought 50 cows.
For Land O'Lakes butter, I just want to clarify, right?
Yeah, Land O'Lakes, they have an amazing international development wing of their company. They do a lot of work all throughout the world. It's good stuff. And they agreed to help us with this. And so I had to go out and buy 50 cows. And I did. And we distributed
them. So you were like, I like this one and this one.
I went to the livestock market in Fallujah and bought like 35 cows. I was 15 short. So then we had to call a couple farmers and have them bring cows to an abandoned lot where we could have our security set up. And we had to, I had to learn from a veterinarian how to examine them to see if they had different diseases or if they were pregnant, because that was determining how much we were paying for the cows. And they actually called me the cow whisperer.
Nice.
From shopping for these cows.
You are a multi-talented woman.
This is a failure story, though.
Okay. All right.
So we gave the widows the cows. We had also agreed to feed the cows for the first few months until they could figure out how to take care of them. And the first time it came to feed the cows, I said, well, I need all of the widows' addresses to deliver the feed. And they said, no, can you just give us the feed?
Mm.
I said, no.
That's starting to sound familiar.
Right. And I said, no, that wasn't the agreement. And we had a lot of phone conversations between my interpreter, my translator, and I and the ladies that night. And over the course of the evening, it became clear that, in fact, the cows didn't go to the widows. But the problem was, is we had an interview scheduled on NPR, like in 48 hours, talking about the success of our project.
Oh, no.
And I worked with my translator, and I said, well, what happened? And she said, well, Jen, well, we're in Iraq. And the women, you might have given them the cows, but they really don't have the power in their families to give them to other widows. And as soon as they got the cows, the men in the family decided who got the cows.
Right, exactly.
And we distributed them to other people in the family.
Yes.
And they're ashamed, and that's not what they intended, but this is what's happened. And I didn't think through that problem. So I had to find 50 cows to justify the success of our project. So I had to go find 50 widows who already had cows and convince them to be a part of the dairy co-op. And I did. So now we had 50 cows again. And we went on NPR and we talked about the success of our project.
So did you say, like, we're actually just starting the project?
Oh, sure.
We've just bought the cows.
Right.
So
yes. It was
okay.
The beginning of the project.
Okay.
But I had
but
to
at least
find...
you didn't tell them, well, actually, we already tried this once. And
that part didn't come out in the interview. But anyway, so we came up with 50 more cows. Well, a couple months later, there was somebody on my team who didn't have a lot of projects. And this was one of our more successful projects at this point. And she canceled my convoy and took a convoy an hour earlier and went out and met with the ladies and said she was in charge of the project again. So I joked
Wait,
that
who
I,
was this?
It was a person on our team.
Oh, my gosh.
And so she stole my cows. So I joked that I had 50 cows stolen from me twice.
Well, what did she do with them?
Well, she went and managed the project till her time was done.
I got it.
So that was my first year. I had a lot of
That's funny.
Crazy stories like that where I did not succeed. But my second year overseas was in Afghanistan, and I had a completely different experience. And I always joke that if I ever finish my first book, then I'm going to write the second book is going to be called The Civilian Survivor's Guide to War, because it's got all the pointers on how to manage the environment and succeed in it. Because there's a lot of things you learn that first year through failure that you can apply to be successful later.
What's another pointer that you... Before I ask you this question, I do want to add one cow story, because there's always a cow story.
We all have a cow story.
But this one is just like a short little snippet. But in South Sudan, we actually had one staff, I think, that asked for time off, and he was going to do a cattle raid. Like
he was going to go steal cows?
Yes.
See? Getting cows stolen from you is a thing.
Yes. And so he actually asked for time off so he could go be a part of the cattle raid.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's a thing.
I wonder if he was involved in stealing my cows.
No, this was in South Sudan.
Oh, okay.
So. Wow. But okay. So what's your tip? Like a survival tip?
Oh, okay. So one of my rules in a war zone, probably shouldn't share. But I'm going to because we're friends.
I like to say conflict zone. I feel like that's a little less harsh than war zone.
Okay.
You don't think about that? That hasn't...
I don't think about that. But I actually frequently refer to it as conflict. So I'll go with you. I call it brownies and booze diplomacy.
Okay.
I never went anywhere without homemade brownies or a bottle of Jack Daniels. Because I have this... saying that currency isn't always dollar bills.
Mm-hmm.
Currency is that thing that you can't get yourself. It's that thing that's in demand that's not easily accessible. And in our everyday life, in the States, currency is money.
Yeah.
We work for money. We need money. We always need more money. But when you're deployed, you know, everybody has money because you don't have anything to spend your money on. But what you don't have are fresh baked goods.
Yes.
And alcohol.
Yes.
And so I worked out creative ways to always have a supply of both. We don't need to go into those details.
Okay.
Get anybody in trouble. But I never went anywhere without brownies or booze. And I would go to places and need things. People would say no. And I'd be like, well, I have a package of Ghirardelli brownies. Or I got a bottle of Jack Daniels. Which one of you do want to make it happen? And I never got told no when those things were on the table. You can't bribe somebody with $100 when you're deployed.
Yeah.
Nobody needs the money. But nobody.
And also that feels like wrong. But it doesn't feel wrong so much to do it with brownies.
Yeah, I guess. But I think it's just not what people need.
You're right. Immediately you tell me the story, and I know who's got this down. Like, in my context, there is a legendary lady named, I'll just say her name, Karen Daniels. She's a legend in South Sudan. And she's a legend because she makes cookies, brownies. She'll make you brownies and send them to you in another country, you know, with whatever little small airplane she figures out is going there. And so she is rocking that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good secret.
Brownies and booze diplomacy. And it did. It always worked for me. And people would come to me. I remember a time in Kabul, it was especially dry. It was all of our trucks that were getting stopped at the Pakistan border. And I even had a black market guy in Kabul that I could buy Tajik vodka off of when things got really rough. But it works. And that's what people need. And so when you become the person who can get you what you can't get yourself, then you get things happening.
Yeah.
So that's one of my tips. But I'm not going to tell you all of them.
Yeah,
you got to buy the book.
I will be the first one to buy a lot of books and then give them to all of my friends.
Awesome. Now I just got to finish writing them.
Yeah. You definitely have to. I can't wait. They're going to be so great. I don't even have stories. I want to write a book and I have no stories.
Oh, that's not
true. But your
Four
book,
years
like,
overseas, you've
I know,
got stories.
Well, I have a bad memory, so that's the problem. I can't remember anything. So I'll have to ask my friends what happened and then just rewrite it.
Yeah.
But do you think you'll go back?
I hope so. I got so much out of those experiences, good and bad. Yes, there were a lot of nights I cried myself to sleep. I also have some of the most amazing friends.
Yeah.
Because of the sense of camaraderie.
Right.
That comes with that experience. And I also, especially in this day and age, in this political environment, this presidential year, and I feel like the word xenophobia is in our vocabulary more than it ever has been. But I hear some of the things people say that I know are the result of the fact that they haven't traveled.
Yeah.
You know, you travel, you work someplace else, your whole perspective on the world changes. And I like to think that I've helped people out along the way. But I know that I've gained way more from the experience than I've been able to give.
Mm.
So I hope my time overseas and my adventures aren't over. I just don't know what the next one is yet.
Yeah. Another part of me just thinks, I mean, there's not that many people who are willing to go, who want to go and do these things. And so if you can do it and you're great at it, like, you should keep doing it.
Well, I think, too, we have to take advantage of our freedom.
Yeah.
You know, maybe we won't always be single women.
This is true.
Who don't have anybody, who's really relying on us to show up every day. And not that the people who love me and that I love didn't miss me and vice versa. But there is something to say about taking advantage of these years.
Yeah.
That somebody's not counting on us to come home and be a part of their everyday life. And so, yeah, as long as that's my situation.
Yeah.
Then I hope I can make the most of it. I hope I have that sense of freedom. And I hope I have the ability to encourage others.
Yeah.
To really break out of their comfort zone. I mean, it wasn't easy to get on that plane.
Yeah.
And if anything, it was probably a little crazy. I remember telling myself, I got this. I lived in South Central when I went to USC.
Oh, my gosh.
I had an apartment on the corner of 30th and Vermont in the early 90s. This can't be much different. And I got to Ramadi, and I realized that was the stupidest thought I had ever had in my life. But But I would tell anybody that no matter how uncomfortable it is, no matter how scary it is, no matter how damaged that I came back and the work I had to put in to get back to normal or this new normal, it was still worth every second.
Yeah.
And I wish more people I knew could have that experience.
I mean, I am scared. You know, it's not that I'm not scared when I go and do all the things.
It is amazing. First thing people ask is, were you scared? And you're like, shit, yeah, I was scared.
Yeah, and I'm scared, like, I mean, because I tend to be on the fearful side anyway. So, I mean, in California, I used to think if I put my hand out the car, it was going to get shot. So, like, I think bad things. And I have a very active imagination. So, but I just say, do it afraid. Like, just do it anyway. It's a calculated risk. And, yeah. So,
and anything bad can happen to you at home.
Yeah.
And there's millions of people every day who operate in those environments who don't die.
Right.
Doesn't mean your chances aren't a little rough. And I've had my own share of close calls. But, I mean, that's where life's really lived. And that's where the stories come from.
Yeah. I mean, we're living great stories, and I think that's the point.
Yeah. I mean, stories that if we don't have our own grandchildren, we'll tell somebody's grandchildren.
Yeah, somebody's. We'll tell a lot of people's, because you're going to write a book, and they're all going to read it.
Yeah. We'll be the crazy next door lady next door with the good stories.
Totally. So I think it's worth it.
And I'm glad it's brought us together closer, too.
Yes, yes. Well, thanks, Jen, for taking the time to be on the podcast.
I feel so honored to be invited. And thank you for the yard work you did today, which is what I'm paying you back for by being on your podcast.
Well, that was my pleasure. I didn't do such a great job. But I know you have to get up early.
I do.
So I want to let you go. But thank you again so much.
Well, thank you. And if the Army did not require me to be there at 6 a.m. tomorrow, we could keep talking all night.
All right. Okay, well, thanks for listening. For those of you who are out there, again, this is Story Hodge, and you can find me on iTunes or on Google Play Music. If you have any questions for me, you have a topic you want me to talk about on the next episode, feel free to shoot me a message on Facebook or by email. Have a good night.